Hi, I'm David Korn.
And I'm Rachel Sklar.
Together,
and we're Blogging Heads TV.
And Rachel, you may know this. I usually do this show with a fellow who's a little bit taller than you, Jim
Just
Pinkerton, who might be the tallest pundit in all of punditry.
I think, unless David Gregory counts.
Yes. Well, I think he's probably even taller than Gergen. But nevertheless, he has left Blogging Heads, I assure you, only temporarily, for greener pastures as an advisor to Mike Huckabee. So he could be back here in, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, or shortly after Super Tuesday. Anyway, I look forward to going.
Well, I won't get too attached. Thanks, David.
Yeah, let's not get too attached to one another. It could lead to complications. But nevertheless, you know, usually in these shows, we do these sort of right-left face-off. And I guess today the point is to maybe have progressive-unprogressive conflict. And
wow.
To turn into a real battle of the sexes. This all comes about because you and I had a quasi-neo-minor disagreement when we were staying in the same hotel, motel, fleabag, flop house
in
New Hampshire.
Oh, come now.
In the Econolodge, New Hampshire, where you showed a somewhat of a sympathy for Hillary Clinton and thought that the media hasn't been fair to her. Now, as the media watchdog for Huffington Post, we should let people know that, although I'm sure you're quite famous among people who watch Blogging Heads TV.
Famous.
As the media watchdog for Huffington Post, I take your analysis quite seriously, but I still wonder if maybe the media hasn't been hard enough on Hillary. So why don't you take the first swing at it here and make your case. Do you really think the media has been unfair to Hillary Clinton during this campaign?
Well, first of all, I think that, you know, whatever the standard of fairness is, that it has to be universally applied. I think it's hard to argue that the standard of fairness and skepticism and mockery and general harshness has been evenly applied as compared particularly to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. I mean, can you argue that? I mean, do you really think so, I guess?
Well, I guess if you throw Ron Paul into the equation, maybe it changes a bit. But give me some.
Sure, it definitely does.
But give me some examples. And are you talking about the media writ large, or are you talking about Chris Matthews?
Chris Matthews is a case unto himself. But I think, the media writ large, that has been my experience, that has been my impression. And I think, you know, one of the benefits and weaknesses to what I bring to the table personally is the fact that I haven't been doing this for, you know, my entire life. I don't have my screen just went. Okay, sorry. This is my first time, by the way. And I'm not on Mac.
Yes, we'll be gentle with you. It's your first time, so there may be technical glitches, but we just bloviate through them.
Yes, okay. Well, I am prepared to do so. Where was I? I was talking about Hillary Clinton and fairness. And, right, I am unencumbered by, you know, Clinton baggage is, I guess, my point. I am Canadian. During the Clinton years, I was in Canada.
How lucky for you.
Well, I mean, I just, you know, I was aware of it without being obsessed with it. So that makes a really big difference. So coming into the campaign, I have found, as I've talked about it with, you know, grizzled, cynical journalists with whom I happen to converse about these things, I found that I have a lot more openness to Hillary Clinton and a lot less cynicism. And I think it's actually very interesting that a lot of the time when I've been sort of agitating for fairness to be applied and sort of the same standard, I have been perceived as being pro-Hillary or anti-Obama when I feel like I'm applying sort of the same standard to both of them and when I can't even vote. So that's been my impression. And if you want some examples, I can furnish them.
Yeah, how charitable of you to come down from Canada to help us with our system here when you can't even vote.
It's kind of like
Neil Young writing, you know, songs about Ohio. I salute you, and we need as much help down here as we can get from you well-mannered
Canadians.
I don't
think you want to go there. If you want to be dissing Neil Young, you'll have a fight on your
hands. I love Neil Young. I'm a big fan of Neil Young, you know.
Right.
I've had some moments at Neil Young shows that I don't even remember. But nevertheless, you give us some examples when you think things have been unfair. Because, I mean, I come to the Clinton issue here with a lot of that baggage. I mean,
right.
I think she and he got away with a lot of stuff in the 90s, and I think in some ways, until maybe even just today, and I'll explain in a moment what I mean by that, I think she's gotten off easy. But go ahead. You're
really? Okay. Well, I mean, this is what's so exciting to me about talking to experienced journalists like yourself. I can learn so much from them. But here's what you can learn from me. I think that the cackle is very sexist. The cackle, which was which got, I think, front page play by Patrick Healy, who, by the way, whenever I see a New York Times article that seems to have a gently mocking or derisive tone about Hillary Clinton or the Clintons, I always look up at the byline. It always tends to be by Patrick Healy. He's the one who
wrote
that.
By the cackle,
that.
For anyone who was asleep for those couple of days, the cackle means there were a spate of stories, I forget even now, a month or two back, about Hillary Clinton's laugh. And that it was people who took exception to her or said she used it not to answer questions. That was the cackle.
Right. So she laughed, and people immediately said, it's contrived, it's programmed, it's not natural. And as a person watching the debates and just, you know, I've been live blogging all the debates at HuffPost, so I've watched pretty much all of the debates, both GOP and Dem, and you know, that didn't strike me. It didn't strike me as false. It didn't strike me as inappropriate. And, you know, on the flip side is I had noticed that, let's say, Mitt Romney always has this, like, little smile on his face, no matter what's happening, a sort of inappropriate perma-smile. So
but people
it's
do
not
make
that
fun
I'm incapable of noticing tics.
People do make fun of George Bush's smirk. I mean,
yes, and rightly so.
You know, but, I mean, I guess, you know, if you're comparing apples and apples here,
I'm talking about inappropriate affect. I personally didn't find her laugh to be inappropriate, inappropriately timed, inappropriately placed, or at an inappropriate cadence. I just thought she sounded like a woman of, you know, her age laughing. It didn't sound unfamiliar. It didn't strike me as odd.
Right.
And so what struck me as odd is the fact that it was leapt on as being so harsh and shrill and called a cackle. Like, these are all words that have negative connotations and sort of misogynistic connotations.
There's no man on the planet who has a shrill laugh, right? It's not a term you'd use with a male, is what you're saying.
You know what? Actually, it's funny because I am thorough about this, and when I wrote about it, I Googled, and I did actually see there was something about Giuliani having a cackle.
Oh, there you go.
But you know what? It was like one hit. So I think we can we please agree that at least the term cackle as applied to a regular-sounding woman's laugh has a negative connotation. I mean, it is meant to conjure up the Wicked Witch of the West and, you know, just like an evil, nasty Ursula from The Little Mermaid. Are these getting to you, these examples?
Okay, I'll give you the cackle point. You have another?
Okay. Yeah, of course. Well, another example actually really recently from NBC Nightly News talking about Andrea Mitchell was doing a report on on the rancor between Hillary and Obama, and they showed a clip from the very contentious most recent Dem debate, most recent before this evening, which should be interesting. And they only showed the clip of Hillary Clinton firing back at Obama and saying, you know, I was, you know, working to combat Reagan's initiatives while you were working with your slumlord contributor Rezko. And I say that she was firing back because Obama landed the first shot on that because he was the one who said that he was fighting for democratic ideals while she was on the board of Walmart. So it was very much an action-reaction, and that moment really ought to be shown as a clip with including both of them. And I was immediately struck by the fact that they only showed Hillary Clinton's Rezko point, which, I mean, it's just a matter of context.
Right, I understand that. But it seems to me, though, you could probably look at any candidate out there, male, female, or in between, and find moments when the media wasn't fair to that person.
Sure, but if we were going to do a thorough cataloging, I bet we could find a lot more that had to do with less that had to do with Obama.
Let me point out, because I think Hillary's, you know, in some ways, has gotten away with murder in some of the attacks that she's landed on Barack Obama. I've written about this a couple of times now, but she's gone out there and has said that Barack Obama was in favor of doing nothing about Saddam Hussein back in 2002. That's exactly what she said when she was on Meet the Press a couple of weeks ago. Now, that wasn't Obama's position. His position was to bring inspectors in. It was the position of, you know, responsible critics of the invasion. But she's out there saying he wanted to do nothing, which is really parroting the Bush attack on his critics. And it's the right-wing response to people who wanted to do something else, to accuse them of having actually wanted to do nothing. And she got a complete pass on that. Tim Russ didn't even, you know, blink an eye when she said that. She went on CNN, and she said that Barack Obama, when he was running for Senate back in 2002, promised to never vote for Iraq war funding. Then he went to the Senate, and he did, you know, indicating that's a pretty big flip-flop. Well, what do you know? I asked the Clinton campaign to back up that statement. And they sent me a statement from Barack Obama that didn't back it up at all. He was against the funding package at the time, but he never made an unequivocal vow. So I'm just saying, well, wait a second. She's out there, and this is prior to New Hampshire and right after New Hampshire, and she's out there just, you know, blasting away at Barack Obama, making these claims that I think are patently untrue, and the media's giving her a pass. They're not jumping on this to go after her. And in that instance, I would say that's being unfair to Barack Obama, and acting as an enabler of Hillary Clinton.
Okay, well, I mean, I definitely agree that there have been...
Oh, we can't agree too much here. Stop.
Oh, no. Well, listen, I mean, I'm not going to manufacture conflict here. Sure. I mean, what I'm interested in is getting to sort of... is peeling back the layers and figuring out why this is. And I agree. Like, there have been unfair attacks. And, I mean, this is how the game is played, right? You isolate a statement, you... spin it as far in the direction you want as possible without changing the meaning. I mean, this is how it's done. And you know, the greatest example of that on both sides is the Reagan commentary, which Hillary Clinton flat out said that Obama said that, you know, Reagan's policies were better. She used the word better, and that he didn't use that word, and that was clearly not what he was implying. However, for Obama to have said about the Reagan comments that they were neutral is, I think, a little misleading, given that he framed it, number one, as a point-counterpoint to Bill Clinton saying that Reagan was transformative, Bill Clinton was not, which, I mean, that's obviously a diss. And that's not my word, by the way. That's Tom Brokaw's word. He used it on MSNBC. And also, I guess in the lead-up, and I forgive me for not having it memorized, but he was sort of talking about it in terms of the country was ready for something more open, entrepreneurial. Like, he used all these words that really have positive connotations. So I think it's disingenuous to say that that statement was totally neutral. I mean, there was clearly a positive appreciation on some level for Reagan, and I as I said at the time.
But you can't believe that Barack Obama is a Reagan fan.
No, I'm not saying that he's a Reaganite and that he's, you know, Alex P. Keaton in a tie with the Reagan poster on as well. What I'm saying is that it was fair game. That comment, you know,
citing
Reagan and doing so in a positive way, I think is fair game for discussion.
I don't think it's fair game, because I was on conference call after conference call with Clinton officials, Mark Penn and other, who kept saying things like, you know, that Barack Obama was approving of the notion that smaller government is better. That's what he, you know, his Reagan comments.
And I wouldn't
have
taken it that far
but,
either.
But you know what? Who was it in 1996 that said the era of big government is over? That was Bill Clinton, which is a far more Reagan-esque remark than anything else. I thought that was a completely contrived.
I know, but see, this is where we get scandal. This is where we get sort of into the weeds, because all of, you know, there are so many people who can't wait to bring, you know, this example or that example of Bill Clinton and what people said in 1996, or, you know.
Right.
To the table of this isolated moment that Barack Obama spent in, you know, the Reno Gazette newsroom giving this interview.
Right.
For me, my reaction is to watch it and draw an assessment. And when I saw that, I was struck by, A, the fact that Barack Obama was mentioning Reagan, just because that is so the GOP drinking game. I'm thinking back to the first GOP debate in the Reagan Library, where every single one on that stage went on and on about Reagan. It was ridiculous.
Well, that was
it would have
disgusting.
Had been running. And second of all,
that was almost like watching necrophilia. It was that.
You know what? Having not watched necrophilia, I can't make that comparison.
Well, it was almost.
I'll take your word for it.
Yes.
Awkward.
I still think in a lot of ways. That Hillary has gotten off easy, but I said until today things changed a lot.
Let's talk about today. I mean, I really could talk about this a lot more, but I'm interested. You know, you've got me hooked.
Okay, I am so glad to have gotten you hooked. You can't see this, but our Blogging Heads fans can. I'm holding a bunch of clips. Like today, there's a good story on ABC News about what Hillary Clinton did on the board, or actually what she didn't do on the board when she was on Walmart. For anyone who claims to be in favor of the working class and of unions, it's an incredibly damaging story because Walmart was very anti-union, and apparently ABC got tapes of some of these sessions where they're bashing unions, and Hillary's just sitting there saying nothing. Then there was a story about, this is not about Hillary, but about Bill Clinton, going off to Kazakhstan and, praising the dictator president there in order to, to help somebody who was making a philanthropic donation to, I believe, his library. I think that, there's a lot of stuff on the Clintons in the past that still haven't gone, been fully raked over.
And that's because, people think it's... 3 million documents at the library.
That's because people think, that it is old news, that it is just old baggage.
I totally disagree on that. That people think that the stuff from the Clinton years is old news and old baggage. No, I'm not talking about facts. I'm not talking about germane, incidents to cite that have a bearing on what's happening now and on her credibility. I'm absolutely not talking about that. What I'm talking about is antipathy. What I'm talking about is the fact that, Hillary Clinton was a gatekeeper in the White House years. She, I can recall someone telling me that, she sat them down and said, this is how it's going to be. Very, meted out press availability, strictly and gingerly. All those years, the sense of her being contrived and controlled and all that, that's something that... that people bring to the table in their contemplation of her now, and that's what I'm talking about.
I think a lot of of impressions that were made in the 90s should be brought to the table. I mean, you weren't around at the time, but there was a whole mini scandal about the fact that she turned a $1,000 commodity investment into a $100,000 return that seems to have been the product of some favoritism. And it's a story that never got fully resolved at the time. And was it illegal?
I just want to be clear about the position I'm taking, because I don't want anyone who's watching this to come away with the impression that I am not interested in excavating the past for relevant details, and that I'm somehow in favor of suppressing or saying let bygones be bygones. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is, all things being equal, and assuming that everybody is operating within the same parameters of legality and good behavior and good faith, and I understand that that is an assumption to make, but let's just run with it right now, that I think that the press generally takes a harsher attitude towards her, and it's harder for her to, quote-unquote, get a break.
Do you think it's because she's a woman?
I think that it's a lot easier to get away with sexism in this country than it is to get away with racism. And I think that when Imus talked about nappy-headed hoes, the focus was on nappy-headed and not so much on the hoes. And
I didn't realize there was a distinction made in that, but go ahead.
Well, I'm saying that the big issue with Imus was clearly, he crossed the line on so many levels, and he often had. But, the sexism wasn't going to push Imus over the edge. And, with respect to Chris Matthews and some of the comments, I was watching Morning Joe the day that Chris Matthews said that thing about how, Hillary was where she was because, her husband had messed around. And I was stunned. I think my mouth dropped open. I really was stunned to have heard that. And I've watched Chris Matthews. I remember I pulled a clip of Chris Matthews and put it on Eat the Press, which is the site I do at HuffPo, in about September, where he said to Chris Dodd, he was interviewing him, and he just blurted out in his Chris Matthews way, do you find it hard to debate a woman? It was just and Chris Dodd, you could see, just feel that moment of shock, and he was no. But it's that sort of thing, the Erin Burnett, move closer to the camera. Yeah, you look great. Ha! That sort of thing. That, you don't get that.
Let me broaden this out, though. Let me put it this way. Do you think what Chris Matthews says matters?
Yes.
Why?
What do you mean, why? Because he's, he's a branded MSNBC pundit. He's got shows on MSNBC and NBC, and he's got tons of airtime, and he's the one who's anchoring. If you don't think that MSNBC matters, fine. If you think it does matter, then it should matter is anchoring their election coverage.
Not to defend or attack anything that he has said. I mean, if do you think other reporters take their cues from Chris Matthews? You know, he has an audience. I think on a good night, maybe his audience is 400,000. I mean, that's really not a wide-ranging show with much reach.
Well, okay, I think that there are two factors here. One is, let me put it this way. When I go on MSNBC, I'm pretty sure that many, many people do not see it. I know it's a finite audience, but I hear from a lot of people in this sphere. So if you're talking about opinion makers and influencers in this sphere, in the political sphere, then those eyeballs do see and those eyeballs are watching. The general population?
But when Chris Matthews even
less.
Says
but
something...
We are talking about sort of in the media and
right,
coverage
right.
in the media.
But when Chris Matthews says something like that, do you think anyone, you know, has any impact on what anybody else does or thinks in terms of how they cover Hillary Clinton?
I think that everything that is allowed to slide and everything that, you know, if it's blogged about on feministing, it's not picked up in the mainstream media. I mean, I think that, you know, you've got two different standards. Okay, you've got the standard of feministing and you've got the standard of mainstream media, and obviously there's a different standard applied. Like, it's not the first time I've written about Chris Matthews, who, by the way, whose show I enjoy very much, and I tend to like his Tourette's-like blurtings because I find them amusing, and I do enjoy watching, his coverage, but that doesn't mean that my mouth doesn't fall open at some of the things that he does and says. Although it's limited to him. That's just the most recent and you know, obvious example. He was sort of made the, what's that word? I want to say, it's not quite, lightning rod, maybe? He was made the lightning rod for male pundits getting away with sexist remarks in the past few weeks, but he is definitely...
Well, you know, I don't, wait a second, I don't want to see any broad swipes against male pundits here. I mean,
absolutely. Right now I can think of two female pundits who have taken positions that I find appalling.
I mean, you mentioned Andrea Mitchell already. Who's the other one?
No. I'm being very careful here. You got
well, wait a second.
I said in an Andrea Mitchell report. Andrea Mitchell covers the Clintons, and I said in this report, I would, you know, I was just citing an example. I wasn't saying that Andrea Mitchell, I've ever heard her take a
right.
swipe. Although if you look on the comments on NBC on the Daily Nightly site, there's often complaints that Andrea Mitchell isn't fair to the Clintons. But I, to be honest, have not noticed that myself.
Okay, so who are the two female pundits you have in mind?
All right, well, no one will be surprised if I mention Maureen Dowd,
okay,
who
yes.
I can think of two specific columns. There was a column that I wrote about in conjunction with The Cackle.
Right.
She wrote, what was it? It was something, I think it was like... It was something comparing Hillary to a nagging housewife, and she was citing her buddy. I'm gonna, by the way, mess up the pronunciation. Leon Wieseltier. I can't pronounce.
Leon Wieseltier.
Wheels. Okay. Well, in any case, I can Google it, spell it, pronunciation. Can't do it. But she was citing him, talking about how her voice is annoying, how she's like a nagging housewife that you don't want to go home to. I mean, it's appalling. That's an appalling. Got correlation to draw, an appalling image to inflict on someone who, whatever else she brings to the table, is highly accomplished, running for the highest office in the land. That's not just a swipe at Hillary Clinton. That's an easy swipe against women. And I really believe that. So that's one example. The next is, it was a recent piece where she sort of questioned Hillary's bona fides as a strong woman, since she had to have her husband, you know, going out and
right.
fighting her battles. Sort of like, damned if you do, damned if you don't. If Bill Clinton was stepping back and not helping out, you know that everybody would be saying, like, oh, God, he doesn't really love her, he doesn't care about her, who knows what, yeah. speculation based on one particular shining moment from their marriage that everybody knows about. So, I mean, and the other person was Peggy Noonan, who sort of said the same thing on Meet the Press two weeks ago. She said that, you know, she couldn't see Hillary as a strong woman because she had her husband helping her, essentially. It's like...
Well, she's Peggy Noonan's a Republican hack anyway, so she'll take whatever,
But that's the sort of thing that's... Nobody jumped on that. no one jumped on that.
I'm sure you did.
You know? Well, yeah, here I am. I'm one person, and I'm fighting. I'm fighting to get this point across. So all I'm saying is that these are things that I do notice. And
all these examples put together, do you think they add up to, you know, a real anti-Hillary tide that has an impact in the real world, that is, in the terms of voting and how people see the election? And
that one's harder. That one is harder because then we
she's
have
not
to argue
so
how much influence the media had on actual voting, right?
Right.
I will say this. I will say that...
because you remember after Iowa and then she won New Hampshire, there was talk that, you know, some people were voting against the male pundits. They didn't like the way she'd been treated. And I just can't believe... for the life of me, that New Hampshire voters, you know, are worrying, you know, making their decisions because they're pissed off at what Chris Matthews or anybody else is saying on cable shows that are not nearly watched as much as Dancing with Stars.
I think
a lot of women turned out. I think a lot of them didn't want to see her. My guess, it's just a hunch, I'm talking to focus groups like my mom, that a lot of them didn't want to see her dispatched so quickly and so readily, that there were some conflicted feelings about seeing the first woman, even if they didn't like her as a candidate, you know, be put aside so quickly, and they sort of, quasi-rallied around her. But I'm not sure that's because of mean things that were said by Chris Matthews or a piece written by Patrick Healey of the New York Times. I think they were reacting to the bigger picture. It looked like the first major woman presidential candidate was about to be, you know, shoved aside.
Well, I think I would tend to agree with you on both of those points. I don't think anybody based their votes, or I would doubt that an entire chunk of the population enough to sway the entire election based their vote on being irritated at Chris Matthews, who, by the way, said that you know, the comment that started all this on Morning Joe the day after New Hampshire.
Right.
But I wouldn't be, you know, it's so interesting you say, you know, focus group of my mom in a sort of semi, not dismissive of your mom, but dismissive in the sense of like, well, just one person's opinion. But there's so many people said that and expressed that.
No, I mean,
I thought,
you know,
the same thing.
What I meant was to defend me and my mom here. Is that
I'm not attacking you and your mom.
That was a joke.
Okay.
Is that after talking to her and talking to other women, professional women, particularly of her generation, you know, I just noticed there was just a lot of conflicted feelings. These are liberal Democrats who were both inspired by Barack Obama, and, you know, reminded of Jack Kennedy or anything else you want to put it, any other way you want to put it. But they also have these conflicting feelings. Even if they don't like Hillary Clinton that much as a candidate, they just, you know, they didn't want to see her do so poorly. It was one thing, they may have been prepared to see Barack Obama win over the long run, but they were not prepared to see her, you know, shoved aside so quickly. So that's
sure.
what I meant. So that was the. You know, I'm not being dismissive of this. You know, people. You know,
but I totally agree.
It's a perfectly legitimate way to, you know, to feel about candidates. A lot of people.
I felt that way too, just in the sense that it would have felt wrong for her to be counted out so fast. You would just want there to be more of a race, and you don't want two states to be the ones to make that decision.
But listen, I don't think people feel that way when it's a man. You don't feel that way, you know. That, you know, if two states, you know, rejected Rudy Giuliani out of hand, you wouldn't say, "Oh, we really have to give Rudy more of a chance here."
I know, poor Rudy.
You know, poor Rudy. No.
No, but I don't necessarily think it's because she's a woman, and I think that you have to look at everything in perspective. In tandem and in context. There are a couple things that happened along the way. I think for me personally, there were a few things that I noticed coming out of Iowa. Okay, so Hillary Clinton got trounced in Iowa. Everybody made a really big deal about the fact that she came in third, even though she came in a point behind John Edwards, and it was essentially a tie.
Oh, 33rd, come on.
Well,
if she had come in second by a point, she would have made a big deal, you know.
I know, but I'm not talking about what the big deal she would have made. And Edwards is absolutely right to, you know, I mean, he definitely stated it as favorably as possible and talked about how, you know, people clearly thought there were two candidates and that sort of thing, even though Obama was 8 points ahead of him.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, there is something to be said for a race that is close versus a race that is not close. And Hillary and John Edwards were clearly very close to each other. So being third, while obviously an indignity, was really played up. So that's neither here nor there. The very next night in New Hampshire, there was a Democratic dinner, and Barack Obama supporters booed Hillary. this was on C-SPAN, and I was watching it in the Econolodge, in the lovely and palatial Econolodge, the smell of which is still in some of my clothes that I haven't yet had a chance to launder. So, charming place. Anyhow, and I was appalled by that. I expected Obama to get up there and say, you know, don't boo, essentially, or something like that. And this was something that I found offensive. I was like, you know, that's not cool. Booing isn't cool. Maybe this is very Canadian of me, but I just don't think it's necessary. And then the next night was the debate. And for me, a very significant moment in the debate was in the likable question when Charlie Gibson asked her and said, you know, said, some people say you're not likable. And she said, well,
That was idiotic. Okay. I agree with you. It was a good debate up to that point, I thought, in Charlie Gibson's
part. I thought the question was legitimate because, how can you not ask Hillary about the likability issue when it is something so often cited? But when Obama, you know, his face tightened and he said, you're likable enough, in a sort of an ungracious tone, you know, that just seemed like insult to injury.
And okay,
but that
got covered. People saw
that. It got covered. It got covered after she won a lot more than it did after the debate. In the spin room after, I found myself in sort of a pundit circle with a lot of, like, someone from Newsweek and someone from Time and some, you know, big names, smart people, and I sort of raised that as a seminal moment for me, and no one else had really noticed it.
To be fair, too, I remember, you know, at the first time he kind of said it under his breath, and it did go by pretty quick.
When
you saw it again, it was very clear. It was very clear upon, you know, second
to me,
viewing.
In that huge room with bad sound,
I was there too,
and no wireless. I know that's where we met. That's where we met. It was clear to me the first time. So that might just be because I'm tuned into those things or more on the lookout. It might be because I have better hearing. It might be because you were distracted by the free soup in the background.
The soup was good. I mean, that was brilliant. I've been going to these for years, and finally they give us hot soup on a cold night. Oh, that was the highlight of the night for me.
I confess I did not have the soup. I only took video footage of it with my digital camera.
You missed out, Rachel Squard.
All right. Well, I'll have to put on my list for 4 years' time.
You think the media should have played that up more?
No. All I'm saying is that I'm not saying the media should or should not have played that up more. I'm saying that I noticed that as a moment. So these are two moments where I feel like, you know, she's being kicked when she's down. This is my impression. And then I'm going to sort of rallies. I went to an event of hers, and I thought she was, in person at these events with a mic walking around, she seems quite likable, you know, very Oprah-like. So, and this, by the way, is not to say that Obama doesn't. I just wrote a huge column about his speech on Saturday night talking about how incredible it was, so I'm just not going to brook that argument just in advance. But those are things that I think set up the teary-eyed moment and the response to it. So I think that all of that plays into it, and I think it did play into it. But I also agree that what also played into it were people saying, you know, this person, we don't want this person to be counted out yet.
How should that teary-eyed moment or near teary-eyed moment, you know, have been covered?
Way it would have been covered if a guy had gotten choked up.
Well, when Ed Muskie choked up, he forced him out of the race.
Okay, people have gotten choked up. I mean, she not even a tear didn't even fall. She got literally it was a question of getting misty-eyed and her voice quavered.
Right,
and
sure.
that happens, you know, a lot. That's usually an indicia of real emotion and on the part of, you know, of male leaders all the time. I think.
And you don't think she played it up?
I don't know. Maybe she did. I didn't see that. I didn't see obvious signs of it. I saw, her recovery seemed a little trite. You know, I'm just really want this country to work again.
Yes,
but
yes.
How do you recover when you tear up in public? I mean, I know that if I'm feeling wobbly,
I go to my quiet place.
Well, if you're in the middle of a room full of people and cameras and reporters,
I
you don't
a
have
moment.
A quiet place. You just do whatever you do to steal yourself.
You know, I have to say, just not that anyone else would find this interesting about myself here. When I first heard about it, I heard about it from producers on the campaign trail at another event that she was coming to afterwards. People had called ahead, and I kind of said, and people were already starting to make a big deal out of it. I was very, I guess you could say, sympathetic to her. I say, oh, you know, I'm sure it was nothing. I'm sure it was genuine. These people, all the candidates, just completely exhausted and put out. And I can see anybody at one moment in time just sort of having a moment like that. But then when I actually finally saw it, it might have even been at the end of the day or the day or the next day, it looked to me like she was, she was ringing it for the audience. I mean, maybe it started genuinely, but then she kind of said, I can ride this baby. But that was just, that's just my own subjective judgment. But the way the media should do this, they should just play the tape, and we all can decide and argue about it, right?
Well, isn't that what happened?
That's usually what, kind of. Sometimes
this tape was played far more than, let's say, any delving into whatever it was you cited from 1996. Like, that's the stuff that gets played.
Now, let me ask you before we finish this edition of Blog Against TV, other than the anti-Hillary bias, do you see any other sort of biases or trends in media coverage of this election that has you worried, upset, maybe even happy?
Well, happy, I guess, because I'm enjoying it. I think there's been a ton of coverage. I think that James Boyce has a great article up on HuffPo today about how the advances in digital technology have completely changed the election cycle. How the candidates going online and right. And YouTube and all of that has just made a huge difference. He talked about how Obama's response to the State of the Union speech on YouTube had 300,000 plays.
Right.
And that's free media. So I think all that is really cool. And I don't really mind the quote unquote horse race coverage, because I think that polls are done, the results come in. It's important to it's presumably relevant data. Present it. I think that in tandem with discussion of issues, that's good. I will say this, because as long as I'm here and whoever is going to have a takeaway that I'm pro-Hillary and anti-Obama, I will say that I think that the media coverage of Obama has been tentative to a certain extent. And the example that I used, I wrote about this I did a Media Winners of Iowa thing, and I just pointed out that I find myself being careful when I write about Obama in a way that I'm not necessarily as careful when writing about other candidates. And I think that I'm not alone in that, and sort of people have expressed that to me. And I'm not saying
careful in what way?
Careful because he is he's African American, and
you don't want to call him articulate.
Well, that's the thing, right? I'll just give you an example.
Well, Joe Biden was wrong, because I remember growing up, it basically came out as sportscasters, white sportscasters, whenever there was a black athlete. This is more like in the 70s and 80s, mainly the 70s, before your time. But anytime there was a black athlete who could stitch three sentences together, they always called him articulate. They never called a white athlete articulate, because they just assumed the guys could talk. So Biden using that phrase, it was sort of a generational giveaway.
Yeah, I'm not saying that attention shouldn't have been drawn to it. All I'm saying is that stuff, I mean, look at what happened after New Hampshire with the Martin Luther King comment, the fairy tale comment, the shuck and jive comment. And that's like a topic for a whole other debate that we actually didn't get into. But the things were getting very, very tense and very charged. And so there's a reason to be careful and make sure that you don't write something that might be taken the wrong way. And I'm not even saying that, I mean, everything, feel free, go ahead, check Eat the Press out. By all means, give me the clicks. I don't feel like there's anything remotely sort of dangerous
Let me throw an idea out here for you. And that is that in this election, the media is probably less important than it's ever been, which may even mean that people like us who do media analysis are in a less important position. And I say that
I say that
because of the point you just made. It is incredibly easy now for people who want to follow the race, who care about the race, to do one of two things. That is either to go around the media and get, you know, information directly by going to YouTube, going to candidates' websites. You know, 20 years ago, even less than that, you couldn't get a candidate's position paper if you wanted to. You could only read about the candidate's position on Yucca Mountain or anything else if a newspaper or a news magazine did an actual story on it. Now, if you want to know what Hillary Clinton and Obama say about health care, you can get it from the horse's mouth. Now, it's good to have reporting on this and evaluative reporting that does contrast and comparison and so on, but you're able to get so much direct information yourself, and secondly, you're able now to get so much more contradictory or countervailing information that you're not just stuck by watching the, you know, what the three major broadcast networks say or what the New York Times says or AP. So there are so many more information sources out there that that are covering things either from a different angle or covering things just entirely differently. So I think that, the expansion of non, non-MSM technology plus the proliferation of media, including MSM media, makes it a lot harder for the media to have, as a general entity, to have an impact.
See, I'm not so sure about that, because this is the sort of thing that would need a Pew study or something. But
Not another Pew study. Please, not another Pew study.
Okay, so we definitely know that the barriers to entry are lower and availability to information is far greater. But does that necessarily mean that the people who are starting blogs and opining are doing that, are going to Hillary Clinton's or Barack Obama's site and downloading their position?
But you just said,
or does it just mean that more people are reacting after they see a debate? So more people are reacting, to the big stories. More people are blogging about the big things that are the daily headlines and not necessarily getting into the weeds.
Well, I'm not just talking about bloggers. I'm talking about people who are readers and consumers of information. You just mentioned that 300,000 people went to see Barack Obama directly.
Yes.
I mean, they didn't have to read about it in the New York Times. This is what Barack Obama said, which would have five quotes and then a lot of characterizations. They didn't have to see a piece in which MSNBC, what anybody else, NBC, CBS, ABC, would take what they think are the highlights of that and then contextualize it and then go to the Clinton campaign or somebody else for the other side.
You're already imputing sort of a high level of interest and time spent and understanding to the average reader. I'm saying that I'm not so sure that just because people are able to go to a much broader range of sites, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not getting the same opinion at the lower level of sites as might have been generated from the very top of the pyramid. The pyramid still trickles down.
I mean, I'll bottom line this for you. I don't think David Broder has the influence he used to have. There's so many more voices.
I'm just saying that the media has the same influence it used to have. Obviously, when it was the big three networks and that was it, Uncle Walter held sway.
Right.
But I think that the converse is not so easily, that case is not so easily made, because a lot of the people who are, just because they have a megaphone doesn't mean that what they are saying out of that megaphone is original or even right. There's a world of people who don't know what the hell they're talking about. I'm one of them.
I believe I only have a job because the rest of the media doesn't do a good job. If they all did everything they should and covered everything that needed covering as it should be, I'd be out of work. And then again, so would you.
I mean, I think I don't like taking a unilateral position. I don't think that the media sucks, and I think that there's so many people out there doing great stuff.
I'm not saying that they don't. In fact, I think a lot of my best friends work for the mainstream media. They do very, very good work, and it's just, I think it's increasingly more difficult for major corporate-owned media these days to cover everything that needs covering and to get to everything. I mean, we at Mother Jones have now a bureau of 6-7 people here, and I'm told that Time Magazine has 4 reporters in Washington. So we have more than that. We can cover in some ways more things than they can. It's it's not an issue of intent. It's not an issue of bad faith. It's not an issue of even being ideologically driven, as a lot of media critics like to latch onto when they criticize the mainstream media. There's some real changes going on now that makes it a lot harder for some very good reporters to do their job as well as maybe they would want to.
Well, I think we found a point that we can agree on.
Oh, gosh, another point. But you've been really a good sport to come on and blog against TV for your first time. I hope you'll come back.
Well, I hope I'll come back, too. I guess we'll see what the commenters think. I have no idea.
Don't worry about those pesky little comments. But since we didn't talk about this earlier, I'll just say now, the way we get out of this is we say goodbye, and we say goodbye. You push your stop recording button, and then we're done.
Oh, we say goodbye, like, together?
Yeah, ready?
That's so cute.
Let's say goodbye.
Okay, one, two, three.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.